I'll reconvene the hearing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just continue ready.
Thank you, Commissioners. I've prepared a short summary which includes a page of corrections which are really just to deal with the corrections and mistakes that I've made in terms of the titular on the cover page of my evidence. Now I've just attached the final page to the current replacement cover page, and the replacement cover page adds in two further parties and corrects the Jack's Point entities. The two further parties that have been added in are Lakehay Stella Limited and Matt Christina, because they of course retain an interest in the sort of default status of subdivision. And my summary of the tax court entities was also incomplete, so I've pulled those the updates and corrections that I made, and I've done so through that replacement cover page. So if I could pick up at para 5. I have structured this evidence along three main issues relating to the default status, the subdivision regime across all zones, excluding rural, provisions relating to subdivision within the Jack's Point zone, and subdivision within the Skerrier subzones, as well as a summary of my evidence with respect to these issues. Since preparing my evidence, the position of the Council has been refined through legal submissions to accept my suggested changes to the wording of redrafted rule 2755 as it relates to all subdivision activities except as otherwise provided, otherwise stated, and the removal of the element of discretion over lot sizes. In addition, Mr. Bryce has prepared a statement of additional information dated 29th of July in response to questions from a panel on access. This statement reconsiders the discretion to provide a more focused matter of discretion over lot size and dimensions, which is limited to the reconfiguration of existing roads for widening, the formation or upgrading, and any provisions relating to access and service easements for future subdivision of the joint land, which may necessitate changes to lot sizes and dimensions. And as I said before, I support the concept of providing for discretionary control over legal access limits within subdivisions. Any consequential changes to the lot layout and dimensions arising from that, and making provision for access and service easements to accommodate subdivision or development of adjoining land. Through the Council's further evidence and legal submissions, the extent of differences to the provisions becoming increasingly narrowed to the default status for subdivision being either controlled or a restricted discretionary activity. My evidence promotes a retention of the status quo in respect of the default status of subdivision as a controlled activity across all of the district, but not necessarily under the same structure as the operating plan. In arriving at this view, I have considered the evidence for the Council against my own experiences, the future decisions yet to be made in respect of the new zones, and the ability to use more targeted methods within Chapter 27 to address issues where they may result in adverse outcomes. The structure of Chapter 27 provides a table with listed activities that apply to subdivision across the district, a second table of standards that apply to all subdivision, and a third table of zone and location-specific standards. Through this structure, the chapter has the ability to address targeted issues commonly associated with subdivisions, such as minimum lot sizes and provisions that respond to a particular area. As part of an iterative process of hearing submissions on the PDP, it is entirely appropriate for the panel, in my view, to establish the default status for subdivision as a controlled activity on a district-wide basis, in the knowledge that this framework may not suit all of the future changes being addressed as part of the hearings and opinions. Chapter 27 is structured in a way to accommodate location-specific provisions, and these parties may provide the appropriate means by which to address location-specific responses for future decisions on planning maps that cannot be appropriately dealt with under a control or restricted discretionary or indiscretionary activity approach. Jack's point. The council's evidence supports controlled activity status for subdivision within the Jack's point and other zones where subdivision will be undertaken in accordance with the structure plan. I also support controlled activity status for subdivision within Jack's point, not just because of the structure plan, but because of the additional location-specific rules relating to Jack's point, providing a range of further and detailed matters of control discretion, providing confidence that access, open space, landscape and amenity values, recreation values and housing needs are appropriately addressed. Paragraph 13, I deal with the scary subzones, and based on the earlier conversation that was going before, perhaps I could lead that discussion to the written response. Unless, of course, the panel body.
Is one that I alluded to when asking Ms. Baker Galloway. In terms of, from your experience with structure plans, are you able to assist us with how they could be defined in the plan and the contents that maybe should be explicitly required?
Yes. My experience in structure plans is also probably informed by the way in which different local authorities use structure plans, and they do have similar words may mean entirely different things for different local authorities. A structure plan, my way of thinking, or in the context of the Queenstown Lakes District Council, is set at a zone-wide basis. So I might look at an area or a part of the zone which is distinct from a secondary planning, spatial planning tool, such as an outline development plan or a spatial layout plan or whatever you call it. So taking the approach in the first instance of a structured plan which may look at a wider area, such as, I'll refer to the sort of example of Jack's Point Zone, what I think sort of makes a structure plan or defines what a structure plan would be is that it determines the spatial layout for areas of development, open space, the protection of any natural.
Can you slow down? I'm trying to write this down.
Determines the spatial layout
of one, areas of development. Two, open space. Three, the protection of any natural or physical features. On a zone or area-wide basis. Second point, it would deal with the integrated layer of the necessary infrastructure, vehicle access, pedestrian and cycle connections, thirdly, methods to address natural hazards. And fourthly, the interfaces between a zone and its surrounding land.
Or water perhaps.
Yes.
So that would be a reflection of what I consider to be the main elements of the structure plan, which would be on that area-wide basis. And that is, as I said before, distinct from a secondary spatial planning tool such as an outline development plan, which would typically address the layer of development within an activity area shown in the structure plan.
But a much more finer grained.
Yes.
Just on the definition that you've provided, you've said at the outset, set on a zone wide basis. Would it be equally applicable if it were to be on a area basis that may contain a number of different zones within it? And put in context, the Jack's point one, in essence, contains a number of different zones. They're just called development areas or the such like, because you've got an area for the education innovation centre, for instance, an area for open space, an area for farming. In a more urban context, would you see the potential for high density, low density, mixed use development contained within a structure plan concept?
Yeah, I think that could be the case. I mean, when I talk about those areas that you've identified within Jack's Point, such as any village, for example, or a residential activity pod, I talk about those in terms of activity areas that sit within the zone, Jack's Point zone. So, I think that you wouldn't necessarily limit yourself to a definition of structure plan that is applied to maybe one zone. It just needs definition.
Yeah.
Whatever it applies to, that it'll apply to it and just be defined.
No, I just wanted to be clear on that.
But the way I am talking about is something that applies, perhaps relating it just to a zone might be limiting. It might be an area that encompasses rural zone or resort zone, or it could be a combination of zones. So I think that's in the definition of what you said about the two areas. But I think the key element of the structure plan is that it's embedded into the plan itself.
Mm.
So, that's the other key difference between a secondary planning tool like a spatial layout plan or an outline development plan, is that they are formulated as part of the district, as part of the implementation of the district plan, and they're not in the plan.
Yes. No, I understand that point. Thank you, that's helpful. Do you have any further questions on that?
Thank you. The other
question I've had, which goes to your district-wide controlled activity, do you see that, and I know that your client's focus is rather circumspect, if you like, but do you see that equally applicable, for instance, on the 260 odd hectares of rural living zone, Makarora?
Well, I think I was trying to stress this point earlier. The way I've approached it is to say, well, you've got a default space for activity. There will be areas that might have particular landscape sensitivity or natural hazard sensitivity, which may demand a different response in terms of subdivision provisions, and I accept that. What I question is elevating the status of all subdivision because of one design. And I, looking at it from a Section 32 perspective, if you like, would be to say, well, what's the most efficient and effective method to address that effect, acknowledging that it might exist? So my evidence is saying, well, that's okay. There will be examples of issues, and sites, including site-specific, zone-wide areas that may have particular sensitivities about them. And the framework of the provisions within the subdivision chapter allow for you to be able to provide for those size-specific responses. And of course, you may not yet know what those sensitivities are until you undertake that exercise of determination of the appropriateness of the zone. zone, or address the submissions on existing zones.
Just in terms of the urban design guidelines,
oh, yes.
Do you consider those to be relevant outside of the urban zones?
The current wording of those guidelines does seem to be urban focused, from my recollection of what they said. I don't, however, see there would be any reason why separate guidelines could not be prepared to address rural living or other environments not covered by those design guidelines.
Chair's looking for his next question. I picked up one issue in your paragraph 92 that I should have asked Ms. Megan Galloway about. So I'll put it on the table and, between the two of you, and give me an answer. You've said there that you understand that the legal restriction on reference to standards, external documents, doesn't apply to assessment matters. I was looking for the basis to you, the basis for that view, and Ms. Baker Galloway, for any authority that would support it.
Well, I won't give the legal answer to it, but my understanding was the problem exists when you refer to the document to trigger the status of the activity based on standard. So if that standard changes, then by default change the status of the activity outside of the district planning process. So that's my planning understanding of the concept. And my further understanding to address that is that if you incorporate into the assessment matter, the trigger of the status of the activity is not determined by that standard. And so it has greater ability to play a part in influencing the outcome of subdivision without the problems around the status being determined by a document outside of the plan. That's my understanding. I'll hand it over to the group to address the.
The main authority we could find is the One Plan Environment Court and High Court decisions.
Yes, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, so as long as the external document is not being used as a strict standard that affects activity status, it can be used in other provisions in the plan that are something else in this method, so a method or an assessment matter. And therefore, you know, so the One Plan decision is, as you know, it's about the use of reference to the model overseer,
yes,
and the version of it is not specified, and it was, and as each version of this model changes, the actual output of it changes, and everyone, you know, that was acknowledged at the hearing. And knowing that, it was still okay, acceptable and lawful to refer to the use of overseer in provisions of the plan as long as they're not strict standards on which the activity status might change.
Yeah, I'll have to back and reread one thing.
Do you want us to forward you the provisions, the cases?
No, just what would help if you forwarded me where in the One Plan decision, because I have it on my laptop.
Yeah.
In fact, I have device, but finding it in the 300 pages of the Environment Court decision.
We can help you out.
Ferguson, paragraph 101, on page 27 of the reference, if we were to agree with you that a controlled activity status is appropriate, do you consider the plan should list any additional standards that might be appropriate?
I think the panel is open to do so if there are issues.
I was wondering if you had any opinion on whether there are issues, and considering it broadly, including the urban zones, not just the rural residential and rural lifestyle.
Of course. The issues that have been canvassed more recently since providing waivers would be just the examples that were provided, the examples that have been made around the access width. And those access widths were a key part of the evidence of our replacement for the council in terms of infrastructure. That my evidence was that it didn't necessarily corroborate with my experience in dealing with subdivision. But I accept there might be examples that might stand outside from that.
Do you think
bearing in mind that the council has not yet notified its transportation provisions, and so there has to be some thought given to that relationship, then there may well be some scope for the ability to address access within subdivision or access to subdivision.
Yes. You mean as in private way widths and things like that? Yes. Would you consider there's some value in having some sort of open space ratio requirement as a standard if you have a controlled activity to set some starting point for discussing the open space contributions on subdivision? We're talking mainly about urban subdivision in this instance, of course.
When you talk about open space, are you talking about the reserve contributions?
Yes.
So, acknowledging the council have a policy which they administer through the open government, and which is updated annually through that plan and the 10-year LPCCP. Which provides for monetary contributions based on land areas. Would that then introduce contributions back into the district, the framework of the district plan?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's a confusing area trying to relate those development contributions across to the subdivision. In a sense, especially if in some instances of the preferences for land.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there is a discretion for councils to whether it accepts land on the subdivision. It doesn't want to accept any rubbish piece of land outside the subdivision. It's
a gullet.
The basic photographic clinic.
Yeah, or sort of school water retention ponds. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And the council they articulate that in terms of the policy, the detailed policy on financial contributions, development contributions actually does specifically address that. I think it would be hard to prescribe or formulate a set rule that deals with the open space. I mean, the government plan provisions, of course, provide for the open space component, open space landscaping as part of the matters of control which would be considered. And that rather appeals because of its rather more fluid and can sort of deal with any changes as the process evolves and the discussions with council and agreement on how those contributions could be dealt with, whether it's land or cash or a combination of both.
That's okay. I think the questions I had on the ski area subzone are probably best left until we've seen the written respond, but they all relate to the matters I raised with Ms. Baker Galloway and any of the.
I understand.
Do you have any questions? Can I ask you to turn to paragraph 122 of your evidence, please, Mr. Ferguson? The point I'm picking up on is your view that policies, two new policies, 27.3, 13.2 and 3, in Mr. Bryce's suggested revision, I can understand why you might have a problem with number 3. I want to focus on 27.3.13.2, which Mr. Bryce suggests would read, enable subdivision which provides for appropriate, integrated, orderly orderly development in accordance with the Jacks Point subdivision located within Chapter 41. You said that that's unnecessary. Is that consequential? On your view that it would, your recommendation that this would be controlled activity under the default provision if that recommendation were accepted? Or,
no.
or would it also apply in the event that Mr. Bryce's view recommendation that it be controlled because there is a structure plan?
No. The reason, the simple reason for that is that an internal potential inconsistency which could develop between 27.3.13.1, which refers you back to the effects of policies of Chapter 41. Now, of course, the first policy for Chapter 41 is the structure policy. And so there is a policy that does specifically deal with the structure plan, the layout development, in accordance with the structure plan for Jack's Point. So I just thought it was redundant and unnecessary, potentially also conflicting with the outcomes of that policy if you then generate a second policy that relates to the structure plan for Jack's Point. So that's all my point was.
So it might be more sensible for clarity in the plan if 13.1 said at the end of it, including the structure plan.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't have any problem with the signpost being put there.
It's just how the signpost is located, mm-hmm. where it's located.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Ferguson.
Thank you, Colonel.
May
see you before the 17th if you've got
questions
for us on what we submit on the
15th. And if we do, it will be late in the afternoon, 4 p.m. or something like that.
Of the 15th?
Of the 17th.
On the 17th, okay, thank you.
Right. We'll let you know.
Thank you very much. Quite brief today because I'm dealing with some relatively confined matters. My evidence is really in two parts. The first part of my evidence addresses the submission made by the New Zealand Fire Service Commission, and I wonder if it's sufficient for me to deal with that question and then move on to Transpower's submission of my evidence in regard to that. But perhaps first I'll just introduce Mr. Hamilton today, who's here from Transpower and is able to answer any of your questions in relation to Transpower subdivision corridor when we get to that point. He's also provided a development guide document that Transpower use to communicate with councils and landowners in relation to development in the vicinity of the National Grid. It's hot off the press, but it provides some useful background in terms of the way in which Transpower subdivision corridors work in a broader sense.
First point of clarification, Mr. Hamilton's first name. Thank you.
Now I have one small correction to my evidence, and that's at paragraph 1.3, where I state that this is my second statement of evidence for the Fire Service Commission, where in fact it's my third, and the reason I point that out is because I do rely on my previous statements of evidence to some extent today. Now, the only outstanding matter in relation to the Fire Service Commission's submission is in terms of whether the matters of discretion in Rules 27.5.5 and 27.5.6 should be amended to include specific reference to the New Zealand Fire Service Code of Practice for Firefighting Water Supply. Now that's New Zealand standard, and the submission made by the Fire Service Commission has been supported by the Regional Council on the basis that it better gives effect to the extent that it can, I guess has regard to the proposed Regional Policy Statement. I certainly share the view of the Regional Council in that regard. Now, I have addressed the code of practice and the way in which it can be included in the proposed plan in substantial detail in my earlier evidence in relation to Stream 2 and the rural zones, and I do rely on that evidence today. I don't want to repeat a lot of that evidence unless it's of particular assistance in relation to subdivision in particular. But in that evidence, I support the inclusion of reference to the code of practice on the basis that it provides great clarity to plan users in terms of what's appropriate for firefighting water supplies. I also know that the Code of Practice is a New Zealand standard and deserving of respect because it is a standard. The Code of Practice is included in the list of documents that the Council has indicated would incorporate by reference in the proposed district plan, and it's certainly not uncommon practice for district plans such as this one to rely on New Zealand standards such as the Code of Practice in this manner.
Elizabeth, can you answer one issue that's been puzzling me? My understanding is that the key issue, the point of issue, is that the standard requires 45,000 litre storage fire water supply fire on site in rural sites.
Yes.
And that I recall that when Mr. McIntosh gave evidence in the Stream 1 hearing, Stream 1B hearing, mm-hmm. we talked about how much water supply was required, and he said that 20,000 was required, it was adequate. And so I'm left in something of a conundrum, saying the evidence that I've heard is that 20,000 is adequate, and you're suggesting reference to a standard that would require 45,000.
Yes, I'm trying to recall what Ms. Bacht has said, and in fact, his evidence for Stream 2 clarifies the matter, and I think what he was referring to is the fact that over the recent years, the fire service has had an agreement with the council that in a typical circumstance, 20,000 litres of dedicated firefighting water supply, along with a number of other matters like the accessibility of that water and hard stand areas and the ability to couple with a tank. It's been agreed that that's an appropriate interim measure until such time as the district plan was notified, in order to prevent a situation whereby the fire service was a serial submitter, if you like, making submissions on every notified subdivision of land use consent where there wasn't reticulated water available. So the council and the fire service reached an agreement that that was adequate, and that was on the basis of a standard residential unit. And Mr. McIntosh in the Stream 2 hearing clarified some of the matters around that and the way in which the code of practice works. And in that regard, the code of practice has, you can either provide 45,000 litres of water or an alternate water supply that is agreed to by the appropriate party at the fire service. So there was some debate in the Stream 2 hearing, I think, around that, the inherent flexibility in the code of practice and how and whether it was appropriate to apply to a committed activity in that context. Certainly the approach to alternate supplies has a benefit to developers in a lot of circumstances, because it allows situations where there might be an irrigation dam or some other alternate supply nearby, a swimming pool or such like, that would mean that a person wouldn't need to provide 45,000 litre supply as well on any particular site. Does that assist?
Thank you for that. So in terms of a cross-reference to the standard, that includes that flexibility to agree something different with the fire service?
Yes, it does.
If it were, in fact, referred to. So from that point of view, a cross-reference to the standard is better for landowners than, obviously, listing a 45,000 minimum.
Yes, the code of practice allows a consideration of the extent of the risk, and counsel for the commission provided some additional details in Stream 2 around what the code of practice provided for, including how different fire risks might be addressed. And there were questions at that time put to Mr. McIntosh around how you dealt with, like, for instance, attached dwellings, multi-unit developments, and those matters. And so there is some evidence, and including the memorandum of counsel, that can assist you.
Thank you for that.
Mr. McIntosh, yesterday, McIntosh was the last word you said. Yes, Ms. McLeod. Yesterday, one of the planners, Mr. Brown, in discussions and questions, he suggested the value of this chapter on subdivision in particular having assessment criteria which at present it doesn't. If we were to agree with that approach, would inclusion of an assessment criteria that referred to the code be a better approach than listing it as a standard to be met?
Well, at the moment, it's in the context of subdivision. Firefighting water supply is included in the notified plan as a matter of discretion. And
yes, but only in the most general terms.
In the general terms,
yes. I mean, in the actual reference to the code, compliance with the code as an assessment matter.
Are you referring to an assessment matter in relation to a controlled activity?
No, we haven't determined whether it will be controlled or restricted discretionary. You are fully entitled to comment on the effect of either.
Well, I've provided, I'm more than aware of the number of submissions that are before you in relation to activity status, and it was on that basis that my evidence covers both scenarios. With a restricted discretionary activity status, I consider that having firefighting water supply as a matter of discretion is an appropriate place for it to be, and it's similar to a number of other servicing matters that tend to sit quite comfortably in that category. My evidence supports the inclusion of firefighting water supply as a matter of discretion. It merely suggests that be qualified by clarifying that an adequate firefighting water supply can be achieved either by connecting to a fully reticulated water supply or by complying with the code, including that inherent flexibility within the code. So it's not triggering a greater degree of activity status where it's not achieved in the context of subdivision. It's providing a clear direction about what would be adequate as a firefighting water supply.
If we were to agree with the previous submitters that it should be a controlled activity, do you consider that would adequately, that this issue can be adequately dealt with as a matter of control?
No, I've suggested in a similar way to my evidence in relation to land use that if an adequate firefighting water supply isn't provided, a higher status or a more stringent consent activity status should apply. So in my evidence in paragraph 3.16, I provided the alternative approach, which says that where you have a subdivision that doesn't achieve compliance with the code, a restricted discretionary activity status would apply.
So you would suggest that if we would accept it should be a controlled activity, that is at least one additional standard that should be.
Yes.
You heard my question.
Yes, about that. Yes, I do think that would be a pro right standard, and that's the context.
Yeah. Thank you. Did you have any further questions on the client service? Yes.
Paragraph 10, given our last discussion, not paragraph 10, but page 10, where you're talking about get this context, because what's I put a ring around the reference to 45,000. That out and comply with the other requirements, given the discussion that compliance with the other requirements might not involve a provision of 45,000 or connection to a fully reticulated water supply. Do you want to reconsider that?
The rationale for that was that the following this hearing string two in relation to the rural zones, there was some question about permitted activity standard requiring compliance with the code, because the code had that element of flexibility. And through panel questions, we discussed whether you could whether you could achieve a simple standard as opposed to trying to prescribe the entire content of the code, but still have the certainty necessary for permitted activity rule that would trigger a higher status of consent. So what I've done in my evidence today is responded to that in the same, in a way that equally responds to the questions from the panel in string two.
I'm now going to pose a legal question that I should probably know the answer to myself, but I'll put it on the table and see if you can assist me. For the same rules about not having discretions that apply to permitted activity rules apply to rules ascribing a higher status. In other words, are you solving a non-existent problem in this context?
I don't think this was actually probably the final matter I had to speak to today, was that when we're dealing with a matter for discretion, it's similar to the questions you were putting to the previous witnesses. We're talking about firefighting with prescribed matter for discretion here, as opposed to triggering a more stringent consent activity status, and therefore a reference to the code in a more generic sense shouldn't give rise to the same concerns.
So perhaps this rule could simply refer to the code rather than specifically to that volume.
I've been more than comfortable with that, and it's certainly a practice I have supported in other jurisdictions.
That was the last one I had.
There are no further questions on the fire service aspect. We can do a Transpower one.
Transpower perhaps can be even more brief. My evidence supports the policy that was included by the section 42A report, and that's policy 27.2.2.10, that specifically relates to subdivision in the vicinity of the national grid. And I have suggested some limited amendments to better reflect the policy direction of the National Policy Statement on Electricity Transmission. These are set out in paragraph 4.7 on page 13 of my evidence, right at the top of the page. Now, the Council's opening legal submissions have confirmed that these amendments are supported by Mr. Bryce, so I'm happy to go into the policy in more detail, or we can move on.
I think you
can move on. Thank you. My evidence also supports the National Grid subdivision corridor provisions that address subdivision activities in the vicinity of the National Grid, and these have been included by the Section 42A report in Chapter 27. My evidence seeks some refinement to the rules to provide greater clarity, specifically in terms of the trigger for non-complying activity status. The 42A report relied on a matter for discretion to trigger non-complying activity status where a building platform for a dwelling or principal building couldn't be located without being within the National Grid yard. In my evidence, I suggest it may not be appropriate to rely on a matter for discretion to trigger a non-complying activity status, and I've suggested redrafting the rule so the rule sets out what's restricted discretionary and where non-complying activity status would kick in, if you like.
I had a question on that, and I think you've partially answered it. Would it be better dealt with just as a straight standard?
As a standard for generic subdivision?
Yes, so that it's within that all subdivisions avoid locating building platforms within the National Grid subdivision corridor is the standard. and if there is a building within the corridor, then it becomes non-compliant.
The rule's a little more complex than that, in that there's the corridor that says you're restricted discretionary if you have subdivision plans within the corridor.
Well, what I'm suggesting, the standard could replace.
A standard could replace it, but
if all subdivision is restricted discretionary in any event, that makes no difference.
Yes, that's right. It's certainly not a different activity status. It's not intended to be. The intention in seeking that role, it's my understanding, is to ensure that Transpower gets the ability and the earliest opportunity to participate in the way in which subdivision may be designed, such that future landowners can have the ability to develop that property without triggering the non-complying activity status for buildings within the yard.
Yes.
Yes. So it could function that way with some careful drafting.
Mm. How has it been working to date in the district? I know that when I heard the Bridesdale applications, the developers had already designed their building platforms to avoid the corridor. Have there been issues in the Lake Hayes estate and shot over country?
I was actually going to jump in there and point you to page 26 of the development guide, which actually has a photo of Lake Hayes as an example of how to do subdivision
right.
From that perspective, showing a nice clear corridor. And I mean, I was involved in that myself, but that, you know, just in the interest of the picture, 10,000 words, that's the sort of outcomes that we're seeking with these corridor provisions.
And Commissioner Robinson and I drove through the Shotover Country one yesterday, and it seems to be exactly the same there.
Yeah, I think I saw some plans actually go over there, and yes, some of them. So that seems to be working well. Our hope is that with these provisions, you know, that we see
just more ensure the same.
Once you have underbuilt, it's too late really. So we're trying to present that situation.
I had some specific questions about the suggested rule revisions.
Yes.
If you want to go there now.
Yes.
I think that's probably sensible. First of all, is there any reason why it needs to be the National Grid Subdivision Corridor? We just can't call it the National Grid Corridor?
No, there's no reason. I sought to include subdivision to be clear to plan users that the yard deals with land use and the corridor deals with subdivision. There's certainly a number of plans that don't include the word subdivision, and I would be more comfortable for it not to be there.
Second, you've deleted C, the point of discretion, of the ability of the applicant to provide a complying building platform. I can understand why you would say that any building platform is necessarily not going to comply. But I wonder if the point might be for subdivisions sitting across both sides of the corridor, whether there would be value in having a point of discretion, the ability of the applicant to provide a complying building platform outside of the corridor.
The reason I deleted that particular matter for discretion was because by providing a complying building platform, you would be a restricted discretionary activity. By including altering the rule such that the restricted discretionary, where you can identify a building platform, means that that's the trigger for the rule as opposed to an assessment matter or matter for discretion under that rule. If you can't provide a compliant building platform, then you will have defaulted to not.
You will miss, yeah. So it's a, effect,
so it's unnecessary.
In effect, it's unnecessary because it's repeating the substance of
the rule. It's the body of the rule itself, and if you can't do it, you'd be non-compliant.
I'll just write it down. One more.
Thank you.
I have nothing further to add.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Young, if you're going to be brief, we can hear you now.
Yes, well, I'm grateful to.
I thought you would be.
And to be, on site, I only came down because I thought you might have a question or two of me, or if I could help with some background on Plan Change 34, so I'll touch on that, but let me bring my stuff up and off.
Yes, sure.
Thank you, sir, and commissioners. I only filed a very brief submission, really to preserve our position with QPL looking at subdivision at the time of the mapping strength, and I assume that wouldn't be controversial, but thought it prudent to record that.
No more controversial than the hearing of the mapping strength issue will be.
I picked up on Mr. Bryce's comment about that particular rule, excluding Remarkable's Park Zone subdivision, the deletion of that, and made some suggestions why we would like to retain it, which I understand has been accepted in legal submissions for the council.
I think the position that was put to us was that we may end up with two subdivision chapters that are operative in parallel.
Yes.
And it may, rather than this one saying what is not in it, it's a matter of Chapter 27 saying what it does apply to, and then by inference, the operative Chapter 15 will apply to what remains. It includes, in addition to the Remarkable's Park Zones, it includes the Franklin Flat Zones, the industrial zones, and I think that was, there's various, several special zones around the district as well. So it's not something
townships.
The township zones, it's not limited to your client's land in that sense. So I think the council's position, as we understood from Ms. Scott, was that it didn't want to have a provision in here that it necessarily then had to change again when it brought in the next stage, if it didn't actually add anything. So now, you might like to comment on
the issue. So
circumstance.
In terms of lists, whether that which includes or excludes, I would identify which list is shortest and take that one, whether it's the excluding or including. But in terms of, I've spoken informally to council for the council, and it's always been, well, not always, in recent times, through discussions with the council, it's been Remarkable Parks understanding that it would not form part of stage two of the review either.
I've heard that rumour.
Yes, and so yes. I guess whether or not that happens is something for another day.
But it may well be stage three.
If there is a stage, well.
Or would it stay operative?
It would not be included.
In
this.
For eternity.
No, but 2022 looks like the date. In terms of 10 years from. Well, I'll take it. Writers Park reached an agreement with the council that this review, which has been commenced and has stages, would not include a Markers Park zone. Having said that, there has to be some tolerance to make the plan work from its high level structure down to its definitions, and we work through those things as they arise. So, and one of the reasons for that, using very common language, is that Franklin Flats have been done to death.
We don't want to.
And no one seems to want to go back there. Particularly the Markers Park zone had plan change 34, which was notified mid-2011, operative November 2012. And that wasn't, you couldn't call that a review of the entire zone, but it touched on almost every activity area. In fact, it did. And fortunately for the requester, for my client, there weren't many submissions that expanded the issues that arose. The council submitted as a regulator, as a regulatory capacity, and there was a full hearing. So there's been a pretty detailed look at Remarkable Park Zone in its entirety in recent times. So all my client's trying to achieve here is it probably doesn't care how the rule is drafted, if it's a list that makes it clear, but however it's drafted, makes it clear that the subdivision of the Markers Park Zone is undertaken by reference to the currently operative plan 2009.
Notwithstanding the incredible number of inadequacies in Chapter 15 of the operative plan.
Well, we would say that there are none in relation to the Markers Park Zone, and that it simply doesn't have a density restriction, it's a controlled activity, and that's worked. As far as we're concerned, perfectly well, but you know, I understand the sentiment about Chapter 15.
Certainly in this part of the plan, I can't see that there's any change, but I would have thought ultimately the council might want to create a connection between Chapter 27 and the Remarkables Park Zone, even if it was only to say what was in Chapter 15, so that we don't have, we've already got another Chapter 15.
Oh, I agree. I think that, and that's all I was trying to do here was create a signpost back so people knew where they were to look and how the plan fits together, because there's a number of implications for the rolling review, such as when does strategic directions kick in as opposed to current district wide.
As soon as it's made operative according to Ms. Scott.
I think that's right, but I haven't found a statement. The strategic directions chapter must have implication or extinguish parts of chapter 3 and 4 of the operative plan, and not quite sure which parts it does, whether it gets all of it or not, but I think the pragmatic and only outcome is it must extinguish all of that, which is in the operative plan, because and fortunately for us, that strategic directions chapter turned its mind to the Remarkables Park Zone. So there's no, and what it provides for a Christmas in the hierarchy. So we don't have the.
And totally within the urban growth boundaries, if we were to choose to retain them.
Correct.
So there's no alteration in that respect.
No, it is an integrated package still. I recall Clyde District Council seeking to exclude ONLs from its review. Because
that would be tricky.
Well, they simply thought.
Well, they got bold.
That's right.
It was more than tricky.
They thought EDS would be all over. Again, talking about it casually, that the EDS would be right, and then it could be a very difficult, time consuming, costly exercise. And the court said, no, you couldn't exclude that and still achieve an integrated outcome.
Yes.
I don't think that happens here with Franklin Flats, the Remarkables Park being excluded, and others. You know that are commercial zones, and then the hierarchies talked about how they fit in and the expected outcome. So from that perspective, we're comfortable with the ring fencing. It is a matter of timing.
It may be some value and an advice note rather than a law or provision. Given, I know, for instance, there's recent plan changes, private plan changes, like North Lake and one on Valentine Road, and both in Wanaka, in the same boat, where they've only just been made operative. They're unlikely to ever form part of this review process, but at some stage they'll need to be adjusted to fit into it, even if it's just changing the chapter number. I don't look. I mean, at the moment we've got a whole lot under Chapter 12.
Yes.
And Chapter 12, I think, is given something else in the proposed plan.
Well, the council will have to, I don't know the council to do this, but it'll have to review those zones that doesn't touch through this process within that 10-year process to decide what it wants to notify. Mm. Might just notify the zone again, not changing it.
Yes.
Hope it slides through. But are you talking about, as part of this process,
a
numbering update that
leads the two speak to each other? I would have thought at some stage they'd have to do something, even if it's only a plan change, just to integrate them without actually altering the provisions.
Yes, and that's certainly something I hadn't thought about that.
Mm.
It takes away some of the concern to my client that the zone is opened up again to public submission.
Yes.
Which, of course, has been the council's concern about the town centre zoning, the PC50 as well.
Yes, well, the PC50 falls into exactly the same category. Yes.
Would seem to me that would work. You could certainly have a plan change that means you have some order to chapter numbers, current operative plan and proposed plan becoming operative. I guess the obligation must still remain at some future point in time. Council needs to turn its mind to reviewing those, mm-hmm. which it hasn't through this. So I haven't spoken to my client about your suggestion specifically, but I think we support that so that the plans speak to each other.
Yes.
And there's more certainty.
Mm. I think there's certainly some room for some advice notes in this plan, and that probably is one of them. It may have a different title to advice note, but that's the generic term, we know what it means.
Yes, well, yes. I don't know if I'll get support from Commissioner Robinson, but I quite like advice notes, I don't most lawyers don't. I don't mind those clarifying statements and plans, provided they're relatively short, concise, and they provide guidance, I can then help. Sorry, I didn't put words in your mouth, Commissioner.
The words I would say is, I don't mind advice notes as long as they don't have substantive effect.
Yeah. You want that maybe guidance, it is.
Mm.
People who want to change it.
Yes, I would like to step to the effect in terms of reading the chapter 15.
Well,
any guide, I mean, I think people.
But you have substantive effect because it remains operative.
It's there, that's right.
And if we start changing this, that then raises the question as to whether making this operative with an operative provision actually alters your existing operative relationships.
So that would be the rationale for speaking only about what is included rather than hooking in at all through that which is excluded. I can see, I can understand that that's a safer approach. I mean, it would be no surprise to you or to anyone in the room, we just want to make sure when a processing planner picks up an application in 2 years' time, they understand what's being ring fenced to as best they can, because it might be as clear as it might be in other districts, but
don't worry, we equally are trying to make sure that those future processing planners have no doubt about what they're dealing with.
Well, I appreciate that. So that was the reason I came down is there was a request in terms of amendment, and I thought it wouldn't be here on the panel if no one was here to speak to or answer any questions. So I've got nothing further to add in the brief submission I filed on this.
The panel has questions. Any further
questions? Well, thank you very much for attending this, Chair. Might
get 9 holes of
checks for it with a bit of
luck. You've been a great day.
Thank you.
In that case, we will adjourn until 11:50 on the 17th of August.
So I didn't realise it's a large cap.
That's why we're pleased to have you now call up rather than come back at 2 for a 10-minute discussion.
Definitely a win-win position.
Sorry, what was it?